From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. Well, it's Wednesday, and that's when we normally bring you our doctor roundtable. This is where we answer your questions about public health, including COVID-19, flu, RSV. But since it is almost the end of 2022, we wanted to once again take a look back at this last year. So joining us today is Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. So Dr. Pate, welcome. But also, can you believe that this is our third COVID year in review?
Thank you, Gemma. And no, I cannot believe this.
I really cannot either. I mean, honestly, it's shocking. So I want to go all the way back to January of 2022. This is when Idaho's Health and Welfare Department had reactivated the crisis standards of care for three health districts in our state. They had to do this because of staff and blood shortages. So, Dr. Pate, just remind us about what the standards are and what they mean.
Yeah, so this was the first time that we've had to implement crisis standards of care. And as you recall, we actually had to do it twice. And so what this is a declaration by the director of the Department of Health and Welfare that a region of the state has become essentially overwhelmed for whatever reason, too many patients, not enough staff, not enough beds, not enough blood or medications or whatever it is, but that the resources are so stretched that it is no longer possible to ensure that every patient can get the same treatment that we would normally provide. It might be that instead of being admitted to an ICU, we don't have any ICU beds, so they have to be taken care of in a regular bed, or, you know, we've certainly seen in some parts of the country where they have to be taken care of in a field hospital or tent or those kind of things. So that's what crisis standards of care are. It means the resources are overstretched and patients will not be guaranteed to get the same kind of care they would have gotten if it weren't for this.
So then we moved to February of 2022. Hospitals at that time were still facing large numbers of patients. This was even as the Omicron variant was starting to slow down. So it seems like more than a year ago, Dr. Pate, but do remind us about Omicron.
Yeah, Omicron was really out of left field. So if you look at the previous variants, the ones that we started seeing towards the end of 2020 and during 2021, they were, if you kind of looked at, think about it like a family tree, you know, if you're a genealogy person, what that would look like. We do the same thing for viruses, but they're called phylogenetic trees. And we look to see how those viruses are evolving. And the previous variants all seem to be kind of going down the typical kind of virus family tree. This one came out like an adopted child, and we're not sure why. I think most of us think the most likely scenario is that it developed in an immunocompromised person because they can't stop the replication of the virus. And so the virus just has the opportunity in a real life person to keep experimenting, to try to change and find out what's most effective for it. And then we come out with something that was really had a huge number of new mutations. And there were scary parts about it. One, that what was clear is it was becoming more transmissible. The other thing was we now started noticing that there was some degree of what we call immune evasion, meaning that if you only had one or two COVID shots, that did not look like, at least in laboratory studies, that that would be enough to neutralize this virus. And so that was why we had the push, as you know, subsequently for boosters. The other thing that we noticed is that the manifestations were much more different. So previously, predominantly we saw COVID as a respiratory disease. It was now becoming clear that COVID, the virus that causes COVID, is really a vascular virus, a virus that attacks multiple parts of the body and the blood vessels. And that's, you know, when we saw a lot of change. And unfortunately, it led to this narrative that, oh, it's milder, you know, because it's not causing the pneumonia and respiratory failure as much. And then it led to misinformation that, you know, viruses inevitably evolve to become milder, which is not true. So that's what we were starting to see.
Sticking to February, Dr. Pate, the Idaho legislature at that time was considering a ban on mask mandates, if we recall. Now, the city of Ketchum voted to rescind its mandate, and the Boise School District also voted to make masks optional after spring break. Then Idaho's public colleges quickly followed suit. So, Dr. Pate, throughout the pandemic, you have had some very strong opinions about keeping kids safe in public schools, just, well, in schools in general. So can you talk about your frustrations over the last year when it does come to kids in schools? Because I will tell you this, even where my kids go to school, they also went mask optional after spring break of last year. I had an eighth grader at the time. Once that mask option went away, I mean, I can get that kid to wear a mask on an airplane. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was certainly a big change. And one thing that was very disheartening to me is that it was a conscious choice to say, you know what, we're going to address the convenience of the majority at the sacrifice of the vulnerable minority. There are many children in school that have asthma, that have diabetes, that have other disorders that make them very vulnerable. And we really, I just feel terrible for those parents, because as concerned as you were about your kids and I was about my grandkids, your kids and my grandkids are basically healthy. There's a lot of kids that this could be really bad for. The other thing that was very disheartening, because I understood the fact that the public had lost patience with masks. I get mm-hmm. that.
Yeah.
What was frustrating, though, is that school boards seemed to only make the choice masks or not masks. You didn't hear school boards saying, well, okay, if we need to do away with masks, what else can we do? You know, because there's other things we could do to make schools safer. And frankly, it wouldn't just be for COVID. It would make them safer for RSV, for influenza, for all these viruses that we're dealing with now. And there was government money that could have allowed that. And even when I tried to push for some of these things with certain schools, only a handful of private schools made these changes that I'm aware of. I'm not aware of any of the public schools that took advantage of other options to make kids safe.
Then we had BA2, and it started making the rounds in the first, you know, about probably 3 to 4 months of 2022. And Dr. Pate, this, health officials were calling this the stealth version of Omicron because it wasn't showing up actually on some COVID tests. So take us back to BA2. What was it? And what were you worried about at that time?
Well, you know, my biggest concern was, you know, we've always had this question in mind, when will this virus run out of options in its playbook? You know, and when will we get to the point where it's, you know, it's clear this virus, as it was evolving, its main objective was to become more transmissible. That's what happened the first 2 years. But really with this is we saw the shift that not only could it become more transmissible by its rapid growth rates, but it was increasingly becoming more immune evasive. So while that first Omicron, we saw that, yes, you need more than your just two shots. You now need a booster. But we were seeing that you know, now the mantra that had been the case that previous infections were also giving you a lot of protection, we are starting to see erosion of that. So it was both vaccinated and previously infected people that were now becoming increasingly vulnerable to reinfection or a breakthrough in infection. And we really didn't know what does that mean for the health consequences. There was another widespread belief that reinfections, kind of like the mantra that a virus continuously evolves to become milder, there was also the mantra that reinfections will invariably be milder. I knew that wasn't true because the very first case of Omicron that was identified in the United States was a man in his 50s in Texas, and it was a reinfection for him with the Omicron, and he died. And so I was very skeptical that reinfections would necessarily be milder. Of course, many are. But now, with more time, we've now come to realize there is health consequences to reinfections. And now with BA2, it really led the question of, okay, it obviously this virus is finding that there are advantages to kind of the basic framework of Omicron. How many subvariants are we going to get? And of course, we didn't know then, but now we know the answer is hundreds.
Okay, Dr. Pate, we are going to go to March of 2022, in particular, the end of March. Now, this is when the BA2 variant was spreading rapidly in Europe and in Asia, and folks who were over the age of 50 got the green light to get another booster shot of the vaccine. So, Dr. Pate, there was a lot of confusion about booster shots, including when to get them. Talk to us about where you believe this confusion came from.
Well, I think it was a multitude of things. I think, one, I don't think the CDC was as clear as they could have been, and it was confusing because there were different age groups, but then it was also took into consideration, did you have underlying health conditions or states of immunocompromise? And then we had more than one choice, and well, which one should we get, or can you mix them, or would there be benefit to mixing them? And then we had some voices out there arguing against boosters. And so I do think it became very, very confusing. It is surprising to me that in this day of social media and technological advances that the CDC couldn't deploy technology better to really help people, whether it was an app or an online feature to help people to figure out, input their information to figure out, you know, okay, what should they do? Now, to their credit, they have just recently released such a thing. So I do give them credit, but I just think we need to move faster and we need to be a lot clearer in our communication, and we need to be communicating. One thing I wish this CDC would do better, when they come out with recommendations, tie those scientific studies and the basis for that directly to the recommendation. They have them on your website. Oftentimes, you have to go searching for that. And I think if we could link those up more, that would be big help.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then in April, the Biden administration's mask mandate on airplanes was in the courts. And a lot of folks wanted to drop masks on every form of mass transit. So I'm curious, Dr. Pate, would you get on a plane now without a mask? And I ask this because I will be very transparent. I don't wear a mask anymore. I might start wearing one again in the grocery store as we get more into winter. The only place that I continue to wear a mask is on an airplane. I don't see myself ever not doing that.
Yeah, I would not get on a flight without my mask. You know, there was a big push from the airline industry to do away with this rule. And I get it. You know, airlines were put in a terrible position. We all watched these various videos and news stories of disruptive passengers that were fighting over this, and the poor airline employees having to deal with this. So I get that. But There was also a narrative that was not completely true about how great the air filtration and ventilation is on airplanes. And it is, mm-hmm. it's good, but I already knew to be skeptical because we'd already had a number of reports that were well-researched identifying transmission of this virus on airplanes. And what people fail to understand is those airplane ventilation and filtration systems are not in full gear when you're on the ground, when you're boarding the plane, when you're taxiing, when you've landed. It's really up in the air. And many of us started taking our CO2 monitors on the flights to see. And sometimes even up in the air, it was not the levels that you would want. And so, no, I always wear a mask. I'm very careful about having a high-quality, well-fitting mask on an airplane. And really, people, just think back. I remember quite well being on an airplane before and a person two rows behind me and across the aisle hacking cough for the whole flight. And 2 days later, when I got home, I got sick. It happens.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Dr. Pate, the exact same thing happened to me back in my 20s. I remember flying somewhere and a girl right behind me, and I'll never forget, she was curled up in her seat. She was hacking. She was shaking. She was feverish. And I remember even thinking then, I mean, this is, you know, we're talking, you know, decades before COVID. And I was like, I'm going to get sick. And sure enough, I did. And I think that, you know, take COVID out of the picture, what masking showed us is that it can prevent you from getting certain types of illnesses, like a cold, like the flu. And frankly, I'd rather not like go to my vacation and then get sick.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I've got a family member right now with influenza, and that person is miserable. And I've had influenza. I haven't had it in about 40 years, but that's why I get a flu shot every year, because it is miserable. And, you know, just ask any of your teachers, ask anybody that you know that's the principal of a school or works in school administration, do they ever have parents bring kids to school sick? They are going to universally tell you, oh, yes, happens all the time. And think about your workplace. How often do people come to work sick? Because maybe they have a pressing deadline. Maybe they feel like they can't afford to take time off from work, you know, and I can remember the days, even as a doctor, where, you know, it was really frowned upon as a sign of weakness if you didn't come to work, even if you were still sick, because we had so many patients to take care of. But I don't know how many patients I've infected in the past because I had to come to work sick to make sure that we could take care of everybody. So, yes, and especially I'm not suggesting that, you know, people should be masking every day for the rest of their lives. But like you said, it for many of us, especially as we get older, it may make a lot of sense during high respiratory virus seasons like we're in right now. That could make sense. Mm-hmm. You know, you go to the grocery store, you get on a plane, you're going to be in close quarters with other people. Maybe you should wear a mask.
Right. I agree. Okay. Let's go to the end of April of 2022. This is when the CDC said that 3 out of every 4 kids in the United States had probably had COVID, and close to 60% of all Americans had caught the virus. And there was a lot of COVID fatigue out there, rightfully so. So were you hearing from folks who were frustrated and just tired of taking precautions to stay safe from the virus? And Dr. Pate, you know, I understand that. I mean, I think when we hear this COVID fatigue, we can think back to other times in our lives, right? I mean, I think about when I lived in Florida and it was the hurricane seasons of 2004 to 2006. At the time, those were the most historic hurricane season. And at one time, you know, here I am working in a newsroom. We were tracking 3 hurricanes at one time. And I remember just thinking like, well, you know what? If one hits, one hits. We've done everything we can. And there is this true, I think, mental and emotional fatigue that you get.
Well, there is. And really, I heard it from all sides. There were certainly the people you're describing that were just like, you know what? Kids don't die. Kids don't usually get very sick. You know, we're causing you know, mental health problems, et cetera, et cetera. So you heard that group. You also heard the other group. I would get calls from parents who, like, you know, one mom or dad has had a organ transplant or has an autoimmune disease. And, you know, these parents have to live in some degree of fear that the most likely thing is their kid's going to get something at school and bring it home to them. So I think we heard it on all sides. I think, though, that if you think for a minute, you know, there's a lot of inconveniences in our lives relative to kids. It's an inconvenience to get a car seat for your infant. It's an inconvenience to, you know, get them all hooked up in it. It can be an inconvenience when your kids are a little older to get them in seat belts. It could be nice to say, oh, kids, you can go down to the pool and, you know, I don't have to go and we don't have to worry that there's no lifeguard. You know, so, you know, we take all kinds of precautions that are to protect our kids, but we don't look at them as being onerous, you know, that, oh, we have to do all these things. And but yet we do in this case. And it just tells me when I see things that are inconsistent like this, it tells me that it's the political influence. It's the misinformation influence of why people are doing this. And what concerns me, especially about that CDC statistic, is that we don't know the long-term health consequences of these infections. We are getting more and more warning signs every day. We probably won't know for years, but people forget that there are many viruses that cause long-term health consequences. When we have allowed this virus to spread so widely, one has to be concerned, what are we going to be dealing with 5 years from now, 10 years from now? I think we're already starting to see some of the effects, and it's not good.
To my knowledge, neither of my kids have ever had COVID, knock on wood. And my oldest, the one who I said I can't get to wear a mask anymore, is also the one that likes to brag that he's never had it. And I'm like, yeah, that's because I got you boosted and I made you, I got you vaccinated, boosted, and I made you wear a mask. So
amen.
Right?
Yep, exactly.
So at this same time, you know, end of April, early May of 2022, we then start hearing about a new drug from Pfizer, similar to Tamiflu. If you get the flu, you take it within 72 hours and your symptoms start to alleviate. So what was this drug and was it a game changer in treating folks who got COVID?
Well, it was, and that medication is Paxlovid, and today it remains one of our most important treatments in our armamentarium. Many of us have hoped for antivirals, so, you know, there was a lot of things that went wrong during this pandemic. It's also important to recognize things that went well. You know, the pharmaceutical successes here are truly amazing. And I'm no fan of the pharmaceutical industry in terms of the economics, but I have to give my hat off to the innovation and the scientific just tremendous successes. So first of all, no person on earth imagined we'd have safe, effective COVID vaccines as quickly as we did. 1 year. That is staggering. Then, you know, we hoped that, because knowing that these vaccines were not going to, you know, work in every case, especially for elderly and immunocompromised, we had been hoping that there would be an antiviral. Here comes Paxlovid. And if I remember those studies back then, showed that in unvaccinated people who were the ones that were mostly dying at that time, you could reduce their hospitalizations and deaths, if I recall correctly, like 85%. I mean, huge. Now, it's not the easiest drug to prescribe and to take, and there's some side effects and so forth, but this was huge. And so it was very, very encouraging. The discouraging fact is that here we are, We've had the Paxlovid all this time, and yet it sits on pharmacy shelves because people don't understand how serious this infection can be, and it's being way underutilized.
So, Dr. Pate, let's go to May of 2022. Now, this is when the CDC said that COVID had claimed 1 million lives in the United States. Dr. Pate, I still to this day, I think that is such a shocking number. 1 million people died and millions of more people were impacted, either by losing a family member, children losing their parents, or folks who survived having the virus who then faced the symptoms of long COVID. I think, Dr. Pate, sometimes we forget about the ripple effects of COVID. And can we talk a little bit about that? Because I go back to some of our very first conversations in January of 2020 when there was this optimism of like, well, we can, you know, if we get this under control, this shouldn't be, you know, it shouldn't end up into this pandemic level. And here we are, you know, more than a million people having lost their lives just in the United States.
Yeah, it really is shocking. What happens is people become numb to these numbers because they see large numbers. I mean, we still have 300 to 350 people dying every day in the United States from COVID, but nobody's paying any attention. And and really, as you say, first of all, back in 2020, I thought even without a vaccine in that early in the early part of the year, if we just all came together, we could significantly restrain the spread of this virus. In fact, we proved that was the case, but we just couldn't sustain it. And now that virus has disseminated so much that we have all these variants because we keep giving this virus an opportunity to mutate. And it's now infecting, I think the last time I looked, it's somewhere around like 75 different species of animals. So, you know, the only virus we've ever eradicated from the world was one that had no reservoir in animals. I think it's almost impossible now to contemplate that we could get rid of this virus. But we know with SARS-CoV-1, the first SARS outbreak, I think that was 2003, that got stopped before it became a pandemic. And then MERS in 2012, that got stopped before it became a pandemic. But both of those occurred primarily in Asian or Middle Eastern countries that were much better willing and able to contain the spread of a virus. So we know we can do it, but we just failed to do it. And now this is a virus we will be living with. Now, I think that the other thing that is very surprising about the numbers is that even now that we do have vaccines, we do have antivirals, we do have monoclonal antibodies, et cetera, we still, I think this year, if I'd have to check the numbers again, I think we've lost about a quarter of a million people. And why is this still happening? And it's because we still have very low, relatively speaking, vaccination rates. People are downplaying this disease. And unfortunately, people are going to continue to lose family members. And I think you mentioned it in the question, Gemma. The most heartbreaking thing to me is all the kids that have lost a parent or 100%. Both parents. And it's just, I remember not long ago trying to help a family that was a single parent. And that parent was so sick with COVID, we didn't know whether she was going to survive. And then the question is, you know, what kind of plans do we need to make for taking care of these children? I mean, it's so sad.
I agree with you completely. I want to jump to June now, because this is when we started hearing about another virus, and this was monkeypox. So what is monkeypox, and what were the concerns about that virus?
So monkeypox is a completely different kind of virus than the virus that causes COVID. It's a virus that we've known about for a long time because it has been quote unquote endemic in Africa. And so we've known a lot about it, but because it was in Africa, we kind of made the assumption, as most of the world did, that, hey, you know, it's killing people and causing problems in Africa, but, you know, why do we need to care? Well, I hope we've learned the lesson of why we need to care, because in a interconnected world like we have now, mm-hmm. you have to realize that new viruses that cause very serious disease are a threat no matter where they evolve. Ebola, it came out of Africa, and we didn't pay much attention until a case showed up in Dallas, Texas. And now here we have it again with monkeypox. And what we missed out is all the years of research we could have been doing about this virus, figuring out how to make effective vaccines, treatments, just in case. And if it never left Africa, wonderful. Let's at least get those treatments and vaccines over to Africa. But we didn't do that. And now we've seen it can really impact the United States. And now we face the potential, because again, there's been so much spread here that it could get to the point, I don't know if it will, where it could actually be a disease that continues to pop up in the United States, because we know it too can infect certain animals. So, you know, we'll have to see, but we keep screwing this up. We have got to change our philosophy about public health. That is the lesson of this SARS-CoV-2 virus, of Ebola, of monkeypox. And it's interesting, this was not a complete shock. In 2020, I was asked to give a lecture for the Osher Institute about mm-hmm. potential pandemic threats. And one of my slides was monkeypox. And there's been others wow. that have talked about this. And now, with the latest outbreak of Ebola, we now think there's a case in the UK.
Okay, so let's go to the middle of August of 2022. This is when the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention changed many of its recommendations around COVID-19, including dropping the 6-foot distancing rule, as well as unvaccinated people no longer needing to quarantine after being exposed to COVID. So, Dr. Pate, were these changes in the recommendations a good idea? And frankly, you talk about confusion. It confused everybody when those came out.
Well, rightly so. And, you know, I have to say, I have had nothing but admiration for the CDC until this pandemic. I have looked back through all my years in healthcare leadership and just been in awe of all the CDC has done and accomplished. They have eliminated so many diseases from the United States. People probably don't know that when the CDC was started, and the reason it's in Atlanta is because we had malaria in the United States, and the CDC set up down there, which was kind of a hot spot for malaria, and we have eliminated it. We eliminated smallpox. We eliminated polio. We eliminated measles. There's so many successes that they have had, and to see what's happened in these last couple of years has been heartbreaking for many of us, because I think we're only now realizing this as I've started reading some of the reports that have come out of the House Select Subcommittee looking at the coronavirus response, that the political pressures on the CDC were unheard of. And frankly, I think in both administrations, both the Trump and the Biden, I'm not giving either a pass on this. And what has happened is that instead of sticking with the science, the CDC has been coming up with some recommendations that are not well based on science and that seem to be to promote a political message that, you know, we don't need to be as concerned about this or as under better control than it is. And it's just really heartbreaking. And unfortunately, it just undermines the trust in them. That is my deepest regret of all of this.
So, Dr. Pate, at the end of August, we heard a word that I think that none of us ever expected to hear again. And that was polio was making a comeback. And as you noted in our last segment, this had been eradicated. And some said it was because of a backlash over vaccines that stem from COVID. How concerned were you to hear that people were getting polio again?
Well, it was heartbreaking. I was born just a year or two after the polio vaccine was first developed. But I talked to my mom to tell me about what things were like back then. And she told me about the fear of having your kids go to a public pool, the fear of seeing all of these kids in iron lungs and with all kinds of assistive devices that looked like they had come out of a war-torn country or something. And there was just a great PBS special on this that I watched with my wife last night, by the way, if people want to take a look at that. It was very fascinating. So this was heartbreaking. And I think what, again, this was missed opportunity with messaging. So we had one case in New York where a man in his early 20s was paralyzed now, which is just absolutely tragic because this will impact him for the rest of his life, right as he is at the prime of his life. And I think what a lot of the public heard, well, it's one case. What those of us in healthcare and public health were thinking, oh my God, because to get one case of paralysis like this, that means depending on which serotype it is, because there's three different types of polio, that could mean there's at least another 1,000 or 2,000 people out there that are infected and don't know it because it doesn't cause paralysis in everybody. So we knew that there was much more spread than this. Now, in this case, it was not necessarily a anti-vaxxer. It was based on religious beliefs. But we really have to focus on this because it's happening in other things too. In Australia, we had an outbreak of diphtheria. I can tell you, I have never seen a case of diphtheria because we've always vaccinated our children. In Ohio right now, we're having a big outbreak of measles. And people forget, because we don't see measles hardly at all anymore, forget that how harmful this can be to kids. And that this is another example where you can get an infection and then 5-7 years later have a devastating complication from measles infection. So I'm very worried, and I have been shocked at how much the anti-vax message has gained steam during all this pandemic. It's very sad. As you and I were talking before offline, never in history have we known as much about public health and medicine as we do today, and never have we done less about it.
Right. Agreed. Okay, so we have about 5 minutes left, Dr. Payton. I want to get to October, because this is when we were learning that Australia was nearing the end of its worst flu season in at least 5 years. Cases of RSV started to appear around our country in large numbers. And there was yet again a new word, triple-demic, COVID, flu, RSV. Why did we start seeing this? I mean, do we know, and can we blame the drop in COVID protections for the rise in flu and RSV cases? Because in the United States, we are definitely not out of the woods as we are ending 2022 when it comes to flu and RSV.
Yeah, you know, the short answer is we don't really know why everything's happening the way it is. On the other hand, we do know that we're in the respiratory virus season. We do know, although these RSV and influenza are occurring earlier than expected and in higher numbers than expected, we know that it does happen every year around this time. We had the warning, as you mentioned, from Australia, and yet, look at what we're doing. Look at how few people are getting their flu shots. Look at how few people are getting their COVID boosters. Look at how even in parts of the country where now hospitals are overwhelmed again in hospitals in California, Texas, the Northeast, Ohio, Michigan, where they are saying, hey, we're running out of beds, and yet public's not doing anything. They don't know to be scared about that. And what are our schools doing? Schools aren't doing anything. And what is especially mind-boggling to me is that even if you were a school and you purely wanted to act in your own self-interest, you would do something about this because you get paid based on physical in-person attendance, and yet they're doing nothing. And we know schools are the main way that influenza is spread in our communities.
Mm-hmm. All right. With about 3 minutes left, Dr. Pate, I want you to look into your crystal ball. What do you think we could expect in the next year? And not necessarily, I guess, with COVID, will we get to an endemic level, but just public health in general? Because as you said, we've learned a lot, but I don't think we're putting a lot into practice.
Yeah, you know, my crystal ball has a big cake of mud on it. It's really hard to see. And you see this playing out. Even the White House COVID advisor, back in, I think it was May, he was predicting mm-hmm. we're going to have this huge wave with 100 million infections. And then he just came out the other day and said, oh, no, it's going to be a piece of cake, which I just can't even imagine how he came to that conclusion. So I think we don't know. My predictions are, number one, we will be having this chat again next year. My additional predictions are that we're going to continue to see these episodes of outbreaks of people not getting vaccinated, like we're seeing with measles, like we've seen with a lot of other things. And that's really a terrible shame, because it is mostly children and pregnant mothers that will pay the price. The third thing is, I think next year when we talk about this, I think we'll have a lot more information about some of these long-term health effects. And I think that we will be seeing the consequences of this strategy on employers, with decreased productivity, people leaving the workforce because of long COVID, increased disability costs, increased healthcare costs. You know, we started out this pandemic with everybody didn't want to shut down because we want to protect the economy. And now, in fact, I think we are going to harm the economy because we did not take actions.
And very quickly, Dr. Pate, when do you see us truly being at an endemic phase with COVID?
You know, I think we'll get there. It's been disheartening that some people have suggested we're already there. We're nowhere close. But I do think we'll get there when eventually either, enough people wake up, because they are now finding out that, oh, wait, it's not just that I need to be concerned about dying. It's that I may need to be concerned about I can't work anymore. I can't take care of my family, those kind of things. Maybe we'll get more uptick in the public health measures, or maybe we get to the point where this virus runs out of new ways to mutate and get around immunity. But we clearly are not there. I hope we're there next year. Could I make any kind of prediction or guarantee? No.
Well, as always, Dr. Pate, we certainly appreciate you and your time and your expertise. We've been talking with Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System, looking back on our special COVID year in review. And we want to take a moment, of course, to thank Dr. Pate for all of the time, all of the effort that you have given us, Dr. Pate, over these last 3 years. We should point out to all of our listeners, Dr. David Pate, he volunteers all of his time with us, and not just every single Wednesday, but he does so much research to keep up to date on all the aspects of COVID, but also all of these other public health issues that have come up. So truly, Dr. Pate, thank you for everything that you do, not just here in Idaho Matters, but I think what you've done for our state and keeping folks informed.
Well, I'm very touched. Thank you, Gemma. It's my pleasure. I wish I didn't have to do it, but I'm glad that I can be of help to someone. And so thank you for those kind comments.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Experiencing the news each day can feel like a journey. With Up First from NPR, it doesn't have to be. Welcome to 15 easy minutes of breaking news, clarity on international and national affairs, all handed over not from some floating voice in the sky, from us, Layla, A, Steve, and me, Rachel. Start your day informed. Subscribe to Up First wherever you get your podcasts.